in a notorious way, the government is coming after them. But at the same time, they are buoyed by the fact that there are others standing with them this time. And so that is giving them some strength to come out to rallies like this, to come out and speak out more.
Early months of 2017. Donald Trump becomes the 45th president of the United States. His agenda is far from solving the real problems of the country. It is to confront ethnic and religious minorities in the first place.
I was pretty shocked when I found out about it, and I didn't know how to react to it because, I guess, hearing stories that have already happened in the States, I kind of would have reacted stronger if, you know, like, there's been a lot of incidents where Muslim students have been spied on. So I wasn't as shocked as some other people were, but I was really worried because why? Why would they spy on students? I mean, we're only students, and not only do we have the freedom to speech, but also what could we be saying that can threaten anyone, you know? Like, what could we be saying that could be so important for people across the country to know and hear? We're just students, regular students like everyone else in any other school, in any other part of the world.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here today to unveil.
And so the first stop in the Trump administration, travel ban on the citizens of 7 Muslim countries, Iran, Iraq, Syria, Libya, Sudan, Yemen, and Somalia. And although after appeals from district courts, the move was blocked and Iraq was eliminated from the infamous list, Trump and his collaborators proceeded with the litigation, reaching the Supreme Court, where an alternative version was approved, but equally harmful to hundreds of thousands of people and families. So as the current administration keeps going, it is no longer surprising that some sectors of society have legitimated Trump's xenophobic discourse. As a result, the deep social damage has been done through dehumanizing ethnic and religious minorities.
So it's disappointing to see that the U.S. Close in on itself the way it is right now. But I also understand that it's really up to us, and we are the ones who can change it. Well, you know, I was a Muslim after 9/11, and it was a pretty rough ride then as well. And quite frankly, at least this time we have allies. I have all these folks here who understand that the Muslim community is being targeted. Immediately after 9/11, we didn't have that. We had no allies.
You know, it's okay to say that Muslims are terrorists.
Right.
It's okay to say that immigrants are criminals. So how do you feel about that? Do you think it's going to change forever?
No, I don't think it's going to change forever because, look, the truth is that I really do believe that the government is us. And if we turn up the volume loud enough on our message, that will change the message in Congress, and that will change the laws. The president doesn't make the laws. Congress makes the laws. So if we really want to see this type of community that you see here become the norm. So while things are difficult, the one only positive thing I can say is that this time, as Muslim, I'm not in it alone. I'm in it together with others, and these brothers and sisters really understand that this is about America. This is about whether or not this country will still be what we want it to be tomorrow.
It was an ordinary morning like any other. People were going to their offices or had already begun their daily work. On the horizon appeared gigantic metallic eagles with an innocent human cargo and tanks full of fuel. Two towers fell, and a Pentagon. Thousands of deaths. And so, the world was never the same again. The attacks were followed by thousands of exclusions, attacks, denunciations, and wars. A demon was born, which in turn gave life to another demon. And whoever was the mastermind behind the massacre, the innocent people paid for the sinners. The world was never like this. Yusuf is an academic who has dedicated himself to his doctorate in Islamic studies and the Middle East. But before going to college, Yusuf was in the U.S. military. Today, it's not surprising if a month passes without a visit from agents of the Federal Intelligence Services. The mere fact of being Muslim is an alarm or a stigma that follows you everywhere. Yusuf is not alone. Some say that every Islamic center, mosque, or Muslim group is under constant surveillance. Even newspaper reports from the Washington Post acknowledged the existence of national databases with the identities and personal details of Muslim citizens and residents in the United States. According to the federal government, this is a matter of national security. But others, like these students who found a spy microphone in the Muslim Student Center of Florida International University, believe that this scrutiny is undue and unnecessary.
I know that there has been a history of spying on Muslims in college and university settings here in the United States, but it was a surprise to me because I didn't think it would actually happen to me in my community. American International Relations, or American Islamic Relations, we contacted them and asked them their opinion on what we should do in terms of Muslims in college and university settings here in the United States. But it was a surprise to me because this finding that we found here. And in my opinion, there's a certain way the media is portrayed in America.
I know, I mean, especially since the events that happened after 9/11, you know, we're under a lot of scrutiny. And of course, if something like this happened, right, in the Jewish or Christian club, you know, personally, I would think that
this would be in the mainstream media.
It would be in an instant, you know, and a lot more action would be taken in a shorter amount of time. So we have, as Muslims, we have it harder on us in order to, you know, bring this awareness to the public. But we have to do what we have to do. We can't just sit around and, you know, let this happen to us.
But in any case, it is worth asking, what has changed since September 2001? To analyze this, it is necessary to see the evolution of the official discourse towards the common citizen, as well as the strategies mapped out to influence public opinion. For the first part, the federal monitoring activities were intended to penetrate the social frames of the Muslim community. The information derived from these activities made it possible to establish patterns of behavior as well as sociocultural superstructure. Once this process has been carried out, with the data obtained, it is possible to create media campaigns for social control. Time is passing by. It is 2017. The semantic superstructure of the message is already out there. The stereotype of the Muslim citizen as an entity different from the Western citizen and unfamiliar with Western culture. The relationship between terrorism, insurgency, and extremism has been established in relation to an ethnically and religiously different community.
When I want to talk to you, if I come with the rude face, would you like to talk to me? Never. Always you go with the positive. So Allah always says in the Quran, if somebody did wrong, better way you can forgive. This is the teaching. Yeah, if you have the courage to take the revenge, if you forgive, you will get the reward and reward and reward from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So this is the teaching of Islam. So how you can say Muslim is going to, it means some people is making against the Muslim, it means they are not a Muslim. So they keep the name as a, like my name is Naseem. So if I am going against by myself, so what makes my name is different? Name is nothing. What you have inside.
Some believe that these stereotypes are no longer exclusive to the federal agencies involved in the subject. They are shared by the media, social groups, and unfortunately, political leaders.
In 1 month, we see like 11 attacks against Islamic centers. And this came due to the fact that the patching and the attacks and from the candidates. Some candidates, they are causing, inflaming the public against Muslims. They are breaking the communities. I don't know what kind of candidates running for the seats to a country that instead of building the country and make it stronger and to bring people together, they are dividing us. And by attacking groups, whatever the group are, we're all against terrorism, we're all against evil and wrongdoing, but we should unite instead of attacking each other.
In one of its most recent reports, the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, asserts that the states of Washington, California, Florida, Virginia, New Jersey, New York, and Michigan have seen the most widespread acts of vandalism against mosques or Islamic centers. On average, each of these states has been the scene of 11 or more attacks against these establishments.
I feel like that's just an excellent way for them to propagate their twisted ideological belief system, which perpetuates violence and keeps perpetuating the stereotype to keep hatred. You know, as long as you can keep the people hating, then nothing has to change. You don't have to change the stat quo. If you have to change the stat quo, then people will lose money. Money is economic. It's about economics. And then I feel like, you know, sometimes I feel sad for people who don't know what's going on. You know, like if they really believe that they're right and they're wrong. They're so ignorant. So ignorant.
But not only violence is active and manifest, it's also visible at other levels. The institutionalization of Islamophobia in educational entities, government calendars, etc., is a case in point.
I have two kids. One, like, you know, he's on 23 now, and one is 14. When they were in high school, they keep asking me. Everybody have like a holiday, like a Christian people have like a Christmas, and Jewish people have a Sabbath. So why can't have like this?
Yeah, what do you say to
them? I said, well, time gonna come out. We'll see. This time they're gonna approve it in district.
Precisely for this reason, people like Abdul Rashid believe that the Muslim community in the United States has a status of second-class citizenship. The stigma of the stereotypes prevails, and the competition conditions are unfavorable, only due to the religious and cultural backgrounds. The situation Abdul Rashid described is similar to the experience of this father.
We are all U.S. citizens, born and raised here. And that's why we're here, because we feel like we don't have no voice, and we're Americans. If, may God forbid, this happened to Tariq, to any other person, like a Jewish boy, you know, the reaction will be different from U.S. representatives, and that's really what's frustrating, and that's why we're out here saying that please be equal. We don't want no loss of life. Even the three teenagers that the Jewish boys that were lost, you know, we're all parents here, we're all moms and dads. Nobody wants a loss of life. But at the same time, this collective punishment that's going on against the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip and in West Bank and now in Shafah.
Ismail speaks three languages, namely Urdu, English, and Spanish. He is concerned about how lies are being spread about Islam and its followers. Meanwhile, for this student, what was once only fear has now become a reality. Hijab, part of women's dress in Islam, has become problematic wherever she has to go to school, work, or shopping.
So they would ask questions and make comments, but the fact that I have to face that with my family as well, because I converted into Islam, it's very worrisome. So it's not only with people I don't know, with strangers, it's also with my family. The House of Representatives, which is the first part of Congress, they're the very first ones to look at these bills that are being considered into becoming laws.
The majority of Muslim nations in the world own the richest hydrocarbon reserves on the planet. Yet after more than a century of bombings, revolutions, and violence, they are looking for a better future, or at least a way to save their lives. Therefore, the exodus of Muslims continues to countries such as the United States. It is not an invasion, as President Donald Trump assures. On the contrary, it is an obvious consequence of failed foreign policies and closed-door interests.
And no one in the U.S. is entirely clear on why the war in Afghanistan happened, but we know the reality is that it's a matter of geostrategic domination. It's a matter of profits. But this war has killed millions of people, and both of the politicians, they're continuing it on. But every survey taken of the U.S. population, every single one that I've seen, the last numbers I saw were like 66% of the people in the U.S. want an end to the war in Afghanistan. They want an immediate end. But that's not on the agenda of the politicians. You know, what the politicians are proposing, that we stay for this long, or we stay for that long. You know, the politicians are proposing, you know, they're putting sanctions on Iran. They want war with Iran. No one in the U.S. wants war with Iran, except for the bourgeoisie, except for the politicians. So, you know, our campaign, like I said, is calling for an immediate end to the war in Afghanistan, an immediate end to the sanctions against Iran, an immediate end to the billions of dollars given to Israel to oppress the Palestinians. And, you know, we want a foreign policy based on respect, based on self-determination.
Much of the Middle East is a region of oil, unexpected governments, and economies, victims of the usury of the International Monetary Fund. In this sense, the campaign of public opinion mounted by the paladins of the Western culture cast doubts on the humanity of Muslims. Europe has a similar history, but as a result of numerous testimonies, it is impossible to deny that in the United States an ethnic cleansing campaign is underway, and they are not isolated cases anymore. America for the Americans, says the slogans of the Anglo-Saxon Empire. The darker your skin, the less welcome you are in this land. And when the doctrine of manifest destiny inserted its requirements in the rhetoric of the day, the result became hatred, exclusion, and violence. But there is yet another America, the damned half, irreconcilable with the mentality of those who insist on racism. It's an America for all, for Christians, for Muslims, for Jews, Gentiles, and atheists. By constitutional mandate, whoever is born here is American and enjoys all rights and privileges. It is here where work, dreams, and efforts are put before creeds, colors, and political orientations. America is a land wherein a rebellious future grows that does not honor the obligations of a third party.
Sheikh Samawi is famous of making transcription or transcribing books and keeping those copies in his library. That's why we may say his library is really
unique in terms of
including precious books.
Besides collecting the books and being a codicologist, he was also a poet. For example, he had this book that's title is At-Tali'a fi Shu'ara'i Shi'a. He is introducing the Shia poets in this book.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is The Teacher, an analysis on the thoughts and works of the most outstanding Muslim figures, historians, especially the Shia ones, during the history of Islam. With me in the studio are two guest speakers for today's discussion, Sheikh Mahtavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya. Sheikh Mahtavi, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to your show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, dear brother.
We want to talk about an outstanding figure whose main outstanding work is regarding Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and his faithful companions. He is no one but Sheikh Muhammad Samawi. And the book that he compiled is Absar al-Ayn fi Ansar al-Hussein alayhi salam. Sheikh Mahtavi, let's start with you, brother. Sheikh Muhammad Samawi, what information do we have regarding his biography?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As you also mentioned, Sheikh Muhammad Samawi, this last name refers to the place he was born in, the city of Samawa, which is located in the southeast of Najaf.
Okay.
He was born in 1292, almost you may say the end of 19th century.
That's right.
He lost his father when he was 10 years old.
Oh.
And from that moment, he started to learn religious studies. Besides religion, he also was learning other sciences as well, as it is reported in the history that he learned mathematics from one of his great teachers at that time, named Agha Reza Isfahani.
Okay.
And in Hauzavi field, he reached the point that it is very well-known point that we may say ijtihad. He received the permission of ijtihad from different scholars of that time, mainly Sayyid Hassan Sadr.
Yes.
Gave him the ijaza for ijtihad. That is a very high-ranked position in Hausa study.
That's right.
Sheikh Samawi is well-known or is famous with one of the great work that he did for Imam Hussein's companions.
Okay.
Yes, Imam Hussein companions. Ibsarul Ayn fi Ansar al-Hussein.
That's right. This is his most outstanding work.
Yes.
Okay.
And
what is the title mean?
The title means the opening of eyes concerning the companions of Hussein alayhi salam.
So it means if you want to be more familiar, is it so, with the companions of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, so you have to read this book.
Yeah, definitely. This is the
take a look at this book.
Yes,
okay.
Also the content of the book is giving you this reference.
Oh.
Yes, because he's talking about the companions of the Imam Hussein, and he's doing kind of tribology.
Oh.
Based on the tribes, he talks
or
about.
Or genealogies,
yes.
Let us say, that's right, the family trees of the Shuhada.
So you may
okay.
say that is a title which is perfectly good for this book.
Yes, very good.
And besides being expert in religious studies, we can say that he had some certain position in the city, like being judge and taking part in the city council in that time in Iraq, and the other political positions and social position that he received at his time.
Okay, thank you much, Sheikh Matawi. Sheikh Ziaini, I've heard that Muhammad Samawi, Sheikh Muhammad Samawi Najafi, was a codicologist too, an expert in Islamic manuscripts, and he dedicated his whole life in researching original manuscripts. That's why they say that Sheikh Muhammad Samawi's library is among the most precious libraries of the Shia world and Islamic world, something like Ayatollah Marashi Najafi's one in the holy city of Qom. Is it true?
Yes. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sheikh Muhammad Samawi, as you mentioned, was trying to collect manuscripts, and he had a very big and enormous library in Najaf, consisting of many manuscripts. And something that is maybe important and noticeable for us and maybe interesting for us is that he used to write the books. If he wanted to have a book and he was not able to buy it, he was writing it himself by his hand to have a copy of that book.
Oh, a difficult task.
Yeah.
Especially the old books, which are, you know, really big, you know,
and
many pages.
And he had this work done for the, you know, the first book that he writes like this, he wrote like this. Well, he wrote it when he was just 12 years old.
Oh.
So he was, you know, very eager.
That's
and
right.
Very, you know, he was enjoying this, right. You know, act and liked it. Besides collecting the books and being a codicologist, he was also a poet.
Oh.
You know, different aspects in his life is interesting.
That's right. Okay.
He was a poet, and he was liking, and he was eager to collect, books that are collection of poems. And even he have some books regarding poems. For example, he had this book that is, its title is At-Tali'a fi Shu'ara'i Shia.
That's right.
He is introducing the Shia poets in this book. And another book that he has, and this book is very important, Al-Kawakib al-Samawiyya fi Sharh al-Qasidat al-Farazdaghiyya.
That's right.
That he is giving some exegesis regarding the very famous poem from Farazdagh.
That's right.
That this poem was given by him at the moment of Hajj for Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salatu wassalam.
That's all right.
Also, he has this book, Ash-Shajaratu Riyad fi Madhhab al-Fayyad, that is talking about the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam and his family and his behavior.
But his most outstanding work is still Ibsarul Ayn. isn't it?
Yes, okay. The most famous book is Ibsar al-Ayn.
We dedicate one separate session to that book, I mean Ibsar al-Ayn and the
Inshallah.
Main content of this book. But Sheikh Mahtavi, I have a question for you. He was very much interested in what we call it as istinsakh. What is this type of methodology, I mean? And is it still used in today's world among the ulama or not?
Actually, istinsakh, if you wanted to translate it or give a meaning, simple meaning, yes, is copying.
Copying, that's
yes.
Right.
This copying today is, all of us know that it's really easy. Even with your cell phones, you may take a copy from a book. You may go to the library and start just taking photos from old pages. But at that time, because at that time they didn't have access to these technologies, so it was really difficult, and we had a very interesting stories with respect to this issue, istinsakh,
yes,
or transcription.
Okay.
This is a technical term for istinsakh.
That's right.
That authors or researchers, because they were in need of having this book either in their library or for their further researches, they would take a book for a couple of days based on the wish of the owner of the book.
Okay.
Sometimes they would give the book only for 2 days. So they had to do all book in another copy within 2 days. So it was really difficult.
Okay.
So Sheikh Samawi is famous of making transcription or transcribing books and keeping those copies in his library. That's why we may say his library is really unique.
That's right.
In terms of including precious books.
That's right.
So,
and this was really difficult, but at the same time, you know, it shows the commitment of researchers and scholars like Sheikh Mohammad Samawi in order to write down a book from cover to cover and keep it for the next generation. Because we know that during different attacks to the Muslim lands, so many books of the ulama have been demolished, destroyed, and burnt away. That's why they feel committed, scholars like him, to keep them safe. Okay?
Yeah, so
istinsakh is this way. I mean, maybe in today's generation of the ulama, as you say, it's very easier task to write down or copy.
I mean, it is not needed to do that, because almost everything that you want to read about, you just Google it and find the digital copy and you may
But safeguarding these istinsakh, I mean, or these transcribed books is still a very interesting field. As I see it myself in Ayatollah Marashi Najafi's library, there is a separate division which is dedicated to the safeguarding of these precious books. You know, the temperature of the air must be at a specific level, the humidity and the hotness, because of the...
The maintenance is
the maintenance is really important of this book and the papers. That's all right. So, Sheikh Ziania, anything to add?
You know, istinsakh was a job at the ancient times, or we can say previous times, previous ages. We have some, you know, funny stories regarding istinsakh also. People who are, you know, engaged with this issue, they say that, for example, some books, they have a good mustansikh, I mean, a person who was professional in transcribing, and sometimes the transcriber was not a professional one, or he was in need of money, and he was trying to write the book very fast. And we have some of these, you know, manuscripts that the transcriber had written at the end of the book that, please forgive me, I was in need of money and I had to finish my job very soon because I needed its money.
Okay.
So being a professional transcriber was itself a very important issue. So the writers of the books or the authors or the ulama, the scholars, we're trying to find good transcribers, and it itself was something hard.
Yes.
You know, because everyone was not able to write.
And it needs its own specific knowledge, I think.
For sure, sure. The handwriting must be good. And we have some, for example, manuscripts today that we are not able to read them easily because the handwriting is not good.
That's right.
So, you know, it's at the beginning we look at it easily, but it's a complicated issue regarding the
especially when you are an alim and writing down the book of another alim, you might put some corrections over there, which help the future generation. Yeah.
This is a big dilemma regarding manuscripts.
Yeah.
And if you write your, for example, explanation in the lines, so the book will be destroyed. So they were
trying. It is not clear whether it is the correction or the original.
So they were the professional transcribers were very, very, very careful regarding writing the book or giving some explanations. If they were trying to give some explanations, they were writing it around in the, you know, free space in the page that it's surrounding the text. So they were not entering anything into the text.
I still could remember some of the books in my father's library when I opened them when I was a kid and look at just the images over there, for example, in a triangle form or in a pentagon form, okay? They were written, the old books were all in the same way, and this method of writing was really interesting.
And when you want to read the book, you have to rotate the book from this
somehow
angle.
Somehow you have to rotate the book. Or
vertically,
horizontally. Yeah, or the annotations or the annexations that are written, I mean, the tashia, I think they say.
Comments.
It was some kind of an art, you know, to show that, okay, I'm able to write this. And also to, you know, put lines between the ideas, different ideas and different subjects.
That's all right.
So it was not just a fun.
A fun, that's right.
It was
profession.
Something, it was a profession at something that was done intentionally.
That's all right. A really good handwriting is a blessing. Of course, today we type it, you know, with different handwritings. But in the past, as you say, something which is easy to read, easy to tackle, easy to understand is really a profession. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziaynia, for a nice introduction regarding the late Sheikh Mohammed Samawi al-Najafi. We will dedicate our upcoming session of our program, The Teacher, to his most outstanding book, Absar al-Ayn fil Ansar al-Husayn Abu Abdullah al-Husayn alayhi salam, which is really an outstanding book, and why Sheikh Samawi compiled such a book. It was very kind of you, and thank you very much. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. This is The Teacher. Visit our website at parstoday.com/Shian Call of Islam page, also a YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah. Assalamu alaykum, ya Abu Abdullah.
I don't fear if from your cradle you depart.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
the limelight.
A new analysis shows that a large portion of Pentagon contracts in recent years have gone to just five companies: Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Raytheon, and Northrop Grumman. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jake Johnson, writer. This article is published under the heading, "Up to half of the $14 trillion spent by Pentagon since 9/11 has gone to war profiteers." Stay tuned for more. To half of the estimated $14 trillion that the Pentagon has spent in the two decades since the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan has gone to private military contractors, with corporate behemoths such as Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, Boeing, and General Dynamics hovering up much of the money. That's according to a new paper authored by William Harting, director of the Arms and Security Program at the Center for International Policy, and released recently by Brown University's Cost of War Project. Published just days after the 20th anniversary of the September 11 attacks and 2 weeks after the last U.S. military plane departed Afghanistan, the paper documents the extent to which the massive post-9/11 surge in Pentagon spending benefited weapon makers, logistics firms, private security contractors, and other corporate interests. The magnitude of Pentagon spending in the wake of 9/11 attacks was remarkable, Harting observes. The increase in U.S. military spending between fiscal year 2002 and fiscal year 2003 was more than the entire military budget of any other country, including major powers like China, Russia, the U.K., Germany, and France. According to Harting's analysis, from one-third to one-half of Pentagon's $14 trillion in spending since the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan on October 21 went to defense contractors, which spend heavily on government lobbying. A large portion of these contracts, one-quarter to one-third of all Pentagon contracts in recent years, have gone to just five major corporations: Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Raytheon, and Northrop Grumman, Harting writes, adding, the $75 billion in Pentagon contracts received by Lockheed Martin in fiscal year 2020 is well over 1.5 times the entire budget for the State Department and Agency for International Development for that year, which totaled $44 billion. But those five corporate giants are far from the only companies that profited from the increase in U.S. Defense Department outlays following the Afghanistan invasion, which ultimately killed more than 46,000 Afghan civilians. Harting notes that numerous other firms, including Eric Prince's since rebranded Blackwater, the Dick Cheney-tied company Halliburton, and GiantKorp, benefited handsomely from the Pentagon spending boom. Halliburton's Pentagon contracts grew more than tenfold from FY 2002 to FY 2006 on the strength of its contracts to rebuild Iraq's oil infrastructure and provide logistical support for U.S. troops in Iraq and Afghanistan, the new paper reads, adding, by 2009, over half of GiantKorp revenues were coming from the Iraq and Afghan wars. Archeng argues that the Pentagon's growing reliance on private contractors to carry out U.S. foreign policy in the aftermath of 9/11 attacks raises multiple questions of accountability, transparency, and effectiveness. This is problematic because privatizing key functions can reduce the U.S. military's control of activities that occur in war zones while increasing risks of waste, fraud, and abuse, he writes, adding, additionally, that the waging of war is a source of profits can contradict the goal of having the U.S. lead the diplomacy in seeking to resolve conflicts. In order to rein in war profiteering and increase government accountability over private firms involved in conducting or preparing for war, Hartung recommends several broad policy changes, including slashing overall spending on war and military operations overseas, increasing the role of diplomacy in U.S. foreign policy, implementing more strict regulations and strengthening the role of inspectors general, auditors, and contracting officers in rooting out corruption, and enacting revolving door reforms such as longer cooling off periods between government service and employment in the arms industry, closing loopholes in current laws, and increasing detailed reporting on revolving door employment. Reducing the profits of war ultimately depends on reducing the resort to war in the first place, Hartung writes. Likewise, making war less profitable decreases the incentive to go to war. Given the immense financial and human costs of America's post-9/11 wars and the negative security consequences generated by many of these conflicts, adopting a new, less militarized foreign policy should be a central goal of the public and policymakers alike, unquote.
Assalamu alaik ya Aba Abdullah. وإنما خرجت لطلب الإصلاح في أمة جدي صلى الله عليه وآله.
The words of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam in dialogue.
صلى الله عليك يا Aba Abdullah.
Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the son of the commander of the faithful Imam Ali, the son of the Lady of Light, the esteemed Fatima, the grandson of the holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the beacon of light which guides towards certitude and conviction, the one who has eloquently said, the person who likes you diverts you from wrongdoing, while your enemy will entice you towards disgusting actions. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the master of martyrs, these are his words. Imam al-Hussein's words in a suggestion to the Cameliers.
قال الإمام الحسين عليه السلام من أحب منكم أن ينصرف معنا إلى العراق أوفينا كراءة وأحسننا صحبته ومن أحب المفارقة أعطيناه من الكراء على ما قطع من الأرض.
Any of you who may wish to change his way and join us in the journey to Iraq, we shall pay off his travel fare and he will receive our best treatment. And whoever favors leaving us, we shall pay their travel fare for the distance they have traveled up to here.
السلام عليك يا أسير الكربات. السلام عليك يا السلام عليك يا أسير الكربات ويا قتيل العبرات. السلام عليك يا أسير الكربات ويا قتيل العبرات. أترجو أمتي قتلت حسينا شفاعة جده يوم الحساب. السلام على الخد التريب.
And now let's listen to Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakhr al-Ruhani.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وبنستعين. السلام عليك يا أبا عبد الله. When Imam al-Hussein al-Salam left Mecca, it was at this in the station at Tan'im in the vicinity of Mecca that he encountered a caravan, indeed a train of camels that were taking many goods from Yemen to Yazid in Damascus. At that time, Imam al-Hussein al-Salam confiscated all the goods that were taken by force, I mean forcefully confiscated from the people of Yemen to Yazid in Damascus. First of all, it must be indicated that Imam al-Hussein al-Salam confiscated all the goods in that train of camels because the Umayyad hegemony never fulfilled the promise that they had made in the peace truce between Imam al-Hassan al-Mujtaba al-Salam and Muawiyah. And it was the right of Imam al-Hussein al-Islam to confiscate all those goods, not only for his own benefit, rather Imam al-Hussein al-Islam confiscated all the goods and distributed the goods among those people who deserved receiving them. This is an important point. And at the same time, Imam al-Hussein al-Islam indicated it to camellias who were over there, I mean to those people who were escorting the camel train, that in case they wanted to accompany him to Iraq, Imam al-Hussein al-Salam was ready to receive them warmly. However, in case some of them wanted to go back to Yemen, to their original point of departure, then Imam al-Hussein al-Salam was ready to pay them the fare of the journey in order to go back to the hometowns. From this we understand that when Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam confiscated the goods in this way, he wanted to express his revolution and his being against the Umayyad hegemony. But at the same time, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam never wanted to commit even this the slightest oppression against those people who had been paid to escort that camel train. From this we understand that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam intended to attract those camellias to himself because of his movement. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam knew well that his movement was the right movement, and in the right movement it would be absolutely pointless to commit oppression against people. True, and granted that those camellias were being paid by the Umayyad hegemony, but those camellias themselves were in need of money, and there were indeed some people who accepted that mission in anticipation of receiving that kind of money. So Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam treated them in a very humane way in order not to commit any oppression against them. Rather, he treated them quite honorably and with due honor in order to continue his mission. Sallallahu alayka ya Aba Abdullah.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of the program Dialogue. We hope that you remain under the auspicious grace of Imam Hussein today and always.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Heartbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.